The Education Gadfly Show starts now. Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, a man who doesn't think Turkey should be in the EU and isn't afraid to say it, Rick Hess. Welcome, Rick.
That's right, Mike. I think Turkey should be in my belly. My goodness, what was that?
That was a turkey sound.
Was it? Didn't sound much like a turkey. I guess so.
That was pretty good turkey.
All right.
Did you have plenty of turkey this past weekend, Rick?
Had enough turkey that it slowed me down. We lost the family football game.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Always a painful moment. I'm sorry to hear that. I won the family football game.
Did you?
Though I was playing six-year-olds.
I was throwing okay. I threw for three sixes, but I got picked at the end. Hated that.
Yeah, very nice. You know, and I also went on a quail hunt.
Really?
I did. I thankfully did not have a chance to fire the gun.
So no quail trembled under the wrath.
But there were many, many Dick Cheney jokes while we were out there.
I could see that.
Yeah.
Were you wearing one of those sweaters you wear?
Yeah, an orange sweater.
Okay.
Yeah. I was trying to experience a different culture, southern culture. I was down south.
That's very brave of you.
Yeah. So have you been paying attention to the news lately? It seems that Bush doesn't have a whole lot of confidence in Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. What do you think of al-Maliki? Or are you more of a Jalal Talabani guy? I hear good things about Abdel Abdul Mahdi, too, but there's always Tariq al-Hashimi. What are your thoughts?
It's like a Simpsons episode, man. At the Quickie Mart.
You got no opinion on this?
I got no opinion.
You don't read the news, do you?
I look at this stuff, but how the heck am I going to judge? These guys all have these unpronounceable names, and they're all in the various factions.
All right, well, one day I'm going to write...
a lot of IEDs.
Very soon I'm going to write a great op-ed comparing the Iraq mess to No Child Left Behind.
That would be interesting. Do you know how you're going to do it?
I'm going to say that implementation is not the problem.
What's the problem?
the original mission was the problem.
Hey, they were going to welcome us, and they welcomed us indeed.
That's right. And every child was going to not be left behind.
That's the argument.
Yes.
In Iraq.
Well, if you want to tell us how Iraq and No Child Left Behind are similar, send us a letter at letters@edexcellence.net. Let's get going, Rick. We're going to start with a game of Pardon the Gadfly. Then we have an interview with special guest Linda Seaback, the Rocky Mountain News columnist.
Rocky. Now I saw where you were going.
That's only on the international version of the podcast.
Okay.
Yes. Anyway, she's going to take us to task. She took us to task in a recent column.
When you say us, you mean?
I mean the Education Gadfly itself.
Yeah.
But hey, a major newspaper wrote about the Education Gadfly. That's kind of cool.
You gotta like that.
So,
they wrote about the print version, so I don't really feel any of that backburn.
You don't
there.
Feel that love.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
or that hate.
And finally, in-house weirdo Liam will serve up a stiff drink of education news of the weird.
Nice.
So let's play Pardon the Gadfly. As you know, we're going to debate three topics for 90 seconds each, and Jen is going to get us started. Go for it.
All right. Topic one. Paul Tuff penned a cover story in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine about children being left behind. He profiled schools like KIPP and Amistad Academy and said that if policymakers really want to achieve NCLB's mandate that all kids perform at proficient levels by 2014, they know how to do it, i.e. replicate the KIPP model on a larger scale. The question, Tuff says, is one of will. Is he right?
On the one hand, this was a beautiful magazine article, great schools, wonderful thing.
Oh, God, I want to beat this guy to death with his tongue. I hate these people.
I mean, the naivete.
I hate these people. They are so painful.
He basically argued at the end that, okay, we know how to do it. KIPP and Amistad and these others show us how to do it. So now we just have to just do it, right? Nothing about all the barriers to scaling charter schools. Nothing about all the political battles ahead. And yet... our good friend Edgy Wonk said this was the best piece of education writing all year.
Well, that's just silly. I mean, this is exactly out of the playbook of, say, Ron Edmonds' effective schools research in the mid-80s, when everybody could identify all the components of effective school communities. And the same thing has been going on for a century. I mean, the same thing goes on in every sector. XYZ is exactly the right theory to run every company, or Theory Z, or Quality Circles, or Six Sigma, until this stuff's debunked because people decide it doesn't work everywhere all the time. You know, KIPP schools attract a certain kind of teacher. They attract certain kinds of resources. They have a certain culture. There's a reason that when districts try to replicate these things, they don't replicate. It's because all of the things that make these schools effective don't lend themselves to this kind of crude replication. The fact that these silly people write these things in you know, in respected, wide circulation magazines and get lauded for doing so was just painful.
All right. Now, one interesting argument he had was that what these schools do is, in effect, they transplant into the kids they're serving a middle class culture. And we'll have to talk about that at another time.
Oh, God. Tough it out.
Okay. Right. Rick is not impressed. Topic two, Jen.
Sam Dillon writes about the achievement gap. It's bad. We know. The interesting thing, though, is that gaps which were closing in the 70s and 80s blew wide open in the 90s. Rick, why did achievement gaps widen in the 90s? Vanilla Ice, Beavis and Butthead, that MTV show with Jenny McCarthy?
Oh, I like that show. Jenny McCarthy. I dug her. I mean, there's two things here. First, let me just be cantankerous for a moment. And let me just complain again that all conversation about education in this country has melted down to race-based differences in grade 3 to 8 tests on math and reading between, you know, Latino and black kids on one hand and white kids on the other. And I just wish – I yearn for the day when we talk about some other stuff as well as this thing with about education. But actually, that cultural stuff you alluded to is kind of neat. I mean, one of my favorite explanations, or one of the most interesting explanations at least, for why you saw the halt in a progress among African-American kids in the 80s, this is put forth by Paul Peterson in a book about a year or two ago, when he argued that you actually saw a fundamental shift in the nature of African-American culture in the mid-80s, that this was a generation that had come of age with affirmative action, that this was a generation that grew up with hip-hop, that this was a generation that grew up with crack in the urban core, and that what you saw was fundamental change in the attitudes of the black working and lower class in relation to school educational attainment starting in the mid-80s.
But Rick, I don't see how the Cosby Show fits into that neat theory of yours.
Boom. Huh? I like that. Absolutely. Huh? Push it. Push it, baby.
Are you just a Paul Peterson lackey?
I try. But is your Cosby Show fixation, is this where you got the sweater thing from?
Or? Well, yes. I do think I – Argyle matching socks.
That's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, by the way, I would be curious someday to know what you think of the Harvard Civil Rights Project's view that this is all about racial integration and isolation and segregation, that we were making progress in the 70s and 80s integrating our schools, and it went in the other direction in the 90s.
It's – yes, there's a whole interesting conversation around the Civil Rights Project work.
Okay, so maybe some other time we'll have a substantive conversation instead of talking about hip-hop.
Hey, but hip-hop can be a substantive.
All right, Jen, what's our last one?
Substantive? Is that the word? Substantive?
Substantive?
Substantive.
Subsistence?
Subsistence. It's hard not to swallow that consonant there, isn't
it? Subliminal?
Or that. What's that little chunk of a word? I guess it's a syllable. Substantive.
I think that might be a syllable.
A syllable. I like that.
Third topic, Jen.
Yeah. All right. Final topic. Bloomberg News recently released a long article about the testing industry, or rather, about the testing industry's seemingly endless parade of errors. Kids whose SAT scores were mistakenly lowered by 400 points, schools wrongly labeled failing, et cetera, et cetera. Mike, what can testing companies do to increase their capacity? In this era of accountability, should we be worried by this report?
Everybody listening knows exactly where I'm going with this, don't they?
No clue, baby.
Well, you know, this 50-state patchwork we have, it's awfully hard to have all these testing companies with 50 different tests, you know, have 50 different state bureaucracies try to oversee it. It would certainly be more efficient and effective with national standards and national tests.
Huh? Well, wait a minute, but isn't the SAT a national test?
Oh, sure. Just go ahead and just blow a hole right into my whole theory. Thanks a lot, Rick. Yes, but much of the report is about what's happening with these state tests. And it is a problem. You get these, you know, really small states with tiny little state departments of ed. They can't afford to hire testing experts because they get hired away by the testing companies as soon as they hire them. It just makes it very difficult to oversee the work of these companies. And, you know, without strong oversight, they're going to make mistakes. They're going to get tests back way late. It's a real problem. It's kind of the Achilles heel of the standards movement.
So how could we deal with this?
So what I'm saying is if we had one test, if we had, you know, all done at a national level, then the agency overseeing that test could have much stronger capacity. You wouldn't need as many experts around the country. You could do a good job overseeing it. And you could figure out a way to do it so it's not just one testing company. I don't think you want a monopoly.
Now, all this lip service then that you've paid over the years to local control and involvement in schools and setting curriculum, so that was all balderdash.
I basically want us to be France.
Well, that's certainly a goal to aim for.
No, come on. You know our argument. Look, it's that the measurement system, the standards should be at the national level. Figuring out how to get there should be at the local level.
But, I mean, when we're talking about the actual composite of a national test, you're talking about this is what people will be teaching.
Right. That's right.
Well, that certainly limits your ability to get the theirs and the thises.
No, I don't agree.
Really?
There are many different ways to heaven, Rick.
Is that original?
No.
Where's that from?
I don't know.
Is that like Bible?
It's an old saying. Like I heard it in yoga the other day.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. I would have guessed it was from one of those Bible things. Like Deuteronomy.
Maybe.
Is Deuteronomy not the funniest sounding chapter in the Bible?
Okay. Thankfully, it is time for our interview. Very interesting one this week. Rick, let's take a listen.
Let's do it.
Joining us on the show today is Linda Seebach. She's a columnist for the Rocky Mountain News. She wrote a column this week actually criticizing an article that was in the Education Gadfly that posited a theory about why many states in the middle of the country are not making progress for their poor and minority students. And we included Colorado in that thesis. And Linda did a very good job taking it apart, showing that it certainly doesn't work for Colorado. Linda, thank you for joining the show.
Oh, thank you for asking me. Given that I had criticized you, I think it's very classy of you to have me on.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you. Well, you make some good points that when we generalized about middle America, some of our generalizations really don't pan out for Colorado. For example, when we asked the question, why is it that many of these states in the middle of the country are not making gains for their poor and minority kids on NAEP over the past decade or so, we said, well, maybe it's because the economy hasn't been very good in this part of the country. You pointed out that's not the case in Colorado. Maybe there's been a brain drain in this part of the country. Of course, not the point in Colorado. So what do you think, Linda? You've been watching education reform in Colorado for a long time. If it's true that poor and minority kids in Colorado are not making gains, at least on the national assessment, why do you think that is?
I'm not sure that I entirely agree with the premise, especially as regards to Hispanic students, because you measure gains from 1992 through, I think it's 2005.
Right.
But the mix of Hispanic students in Colorado in 1992 was very different from the mix 13 or 14 years later. So you're comparing, as I said, I think in one of my emails, Montana with Texas. The Hispanic students who were here in 1992 typically came from relatively long-established families, and Colorado has had Spanish-speaking settlements since the 1500s, whereas the kids being tested in 2003 or 4, whenever it was, have a much larger percentage of recent immigrants, many of them illegal, many of them in families where nobody speaks English when they arrive, many of them in families where the parents have barely a grade school education, if that.
Okay.
So you could be doing very well with all these groups, and the average wouldn't look to have moved at all.
So perhaps the Hispanic students who have been here from the beginning, maybe, you know, eighth graders who have been in Colorado since kindergarten, might be making progress, but that progress doesn't show up because of the new arrivals that are kind of bringing the scores down. So,
well, yeah, that plus the fact that you're comparing the 1992 mix with the 2004 mix.
Right.
And they're very different kinds of students.
Well, that's fair, although I wonder if there's any reason to believe that that's different than for other states. So, for example, a little, you know, to your south and east, you know, Texas has made dramatic gains, including for its Hispanic students in reading and in math. Florida has done the same. You know, is there something special you think about the demographic trends in Colorado? I mean, or is it just possible that Colorado isn't embracing the same strong education reforms as other states?
They're so different. It's really hard to tell. In Florida, you got Cubans. In Colorado, you have Mexicans. They're not the same population.
Right.
And while there certainly have always been many Hispanics from Mexico in Texas, it's probably the same kinds of students who were there 10 or 15 years ago.
Okay, so perhaps
now,
this
demo... That's something you would have to check, right. But unfortunately you can't get that out of NAEP because they don't record that kind of information.
All right, well, good. Well, you know, and it's true, of course, that is always the case with NAEP, and we tried to be clear in our piece that we were speculating. It's still a big question. You see this big hole in the middle of the country where poor and minority students haven't made progress. Around the edges of the country, on the coast, there seems to be greater gains. And I think it's still an open question about why that's happening. And I think the question goes on. We'd welcome your thoughts out there, listeners. But Linda, thanks for coming on the show and sharing your thoughts with us.
Well, it's an interesting question, and I will be giving it some thought. So thanks for asking.
Okay. Thanks so much. So what do you think, Rick? She thinks that Colorado is not making progress because the kids that are getting tested now are different than the kids that got tested before, that Hispanic kids are different than Hispanic kids before. What do you take of all this demographic explanation? Or do you think that maybe Colorado just doesn't have it together?
Well, first, dude, she's not with the Iraqi news. She's with the Rocky Mountain news in Colorado. Makes much more sense now.
Yes, this is news only to you.
Look, I mean, right, right. I mean, there's a laundry list of excuses one can always come up with. The kids being different, as in this cohort, are different. This stuff, you know, you can certainly buy this for a particular locality or for a particular state for a limited window of time. The notion that you find this stuff ongoing for a stretch of years in a larger geographic region, and particularly a geographic region which is actually seeing less influx, arguably, than other areas of the country, is a pretty weak response to kind of systemic concerns about student achievement. So I think the point is that individually, each concern she raises is a reasonable one. In this case and together, I don't find them particularly persuasive myself.
All right. Well, there you go. Very serious, Rick. So let's have some fun now. It is time for everyone's favorite education news of the weird with our special correspondent, Liam Julian, back from his Thanksgiving holiday. Liam, what's weird this week?
Mike, Khalid Shahu is out of a job. The former Spanish teacher at Smithfield Selma High School near Raleigh, North Carolina, resigned last week. Khalid's departure was catalyzed by a word search assignment he prepared for one of his classes. Apparently, as students searched through the puzzle for phrases such as hola amigo and yo quiero Taco Bell, they instead came across lots of English words like destroy and America and Allah. According to the local Islamic Association's president, Shaquille Ahmed, Khalid made the puzzle while watching news reports about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Thus, he incorporated a paragraph into his word search that contained sentences like, quote, Hamas is not a terrorist group, unquote, and, quote, destroy America, a country where evil is sponsored, unquote. Sophomore Chris Daniels was one student who perceived something odd with the word search. He told reporters that the assignment caught his attention because it was handwritten. They were usually typed.
Mm-hmm.
Rick, why are high school kids doing word searches?
Well, in my experience, it's typically because a teacher is hungover and is trying to come up with a quick and dirty activity first thing in the a.m. But, Mike, what's your take?
Well, the funny thing about the story was that it said that the teacher's defense was that he did it very, very impulsively. You know, something angered him and he did it impulsively. How do you create a word search with that much language impulsively? I mean, that takes a lot of skill and thought and time.
Well, what do they mean exactly by a word search? Is this one of those like Boggle kind of deals?
Or? Yeah, we have to circle the word. You know, there's a bunch of letters and you have to find the words within them.
So did they also have Yo Quiero Taco Bell in there? I'm confused.
I don't know. I think Liam might have embellished.
I just played off the stereotype for laughs. Cheap laughs.
Oh, I see. Okay. That's I was going to say, that would have been funny to see Destroy America right next to Yo Quiero Taco Bell.
Well, and I think it's fair to point out that it is possible to get fired as a public school teacher in this country.
He resigned.
Oh, he resigned. Oh, is that right? Or else it would still be an arbitration. Yeah? Okay. Now, well, and it's probably not officially against his work contract to encourage his students to hate America. And
well, that's an interesting question, right? This is one of the concerns about school choice, is that you'll have schools that hate America open up.
Right.
What do you do if they're state-run schools and they still hate America?
That's right. And you don't want – I mean, do we go to loyalty oaths? I mean, that gets all very complicated and sticky.
I mean, and why did the guy have to resign? I mean, if we're just going to embrace
– Well, at the end of the day, Rick, let's face it. Those words were not in Spanish.
Ah! Or maybe are we sure that this wasn't a puzzle translated to Spanish?
I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that was it. That's the reason.
That's true. The kids would have never figured it out otherwise.
Well, that is all the time we have for this week. Thank you for joining us. Don't forget to read the original Education Gadfly at www.edexcellence.net. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.